Hi, I'm Deb O'Dykes, and welcome to this episode of Faith and Reason 360. April is Women's History Month, and today our guests are Donna Ladd, CEO and Editor-in-Chief of the Jackson Free Press in Jackson, Mississippi. Ann Phelps is currently serving as the Interim Director of Religious Life at Millsaps College, in addition to her ongoing work as a freelance sacred musician, liturgist, and teacher. And Kate McNeil is Chief of Staff, Telecommunications Industry Business at SAP, and Kate is a graduate of Stanford. Thanks for being here today. I'm going to start with this first question, Donna, pretty much directed towards you. Why are there so few women in journalism in not only just Mississippi, but across the nation?
Well, I think it's, you know, as far as the why, I think it has a lot to do with just why there's so few women in a lot of industries, you know. I think there are conflicting things to look at in it. Like when I go these days and talk to journalism classes in journalism schools, often I'm talking to mostly women in the classes. And 10 years ago, there were a lot more men in those classes. And so in a way, you'd think that's encouraging. But I think that part of the reason for that is because of the real and perceived downturns in the journalism world and the ability to make a lot of money or keep a regular job. My sense is that a lot of men are not going directly toward journalism. They may end up there. And so I think that's the way it is now, which could bode okay for women in the future as far as getting journalism. But then on the other hand, the realities are that in newsrooms, in general, like there's a study that just came out that I was looking at this morning that is about, that's basically showing how across the U.S. that as far as women reporting news, like in serious subjects, right, that 60% of, 61.9% of newspapers, men report the news. Broadcast, men report 74.8%, yeah. Online news 53.9%, wires 62.4%. So I think that what ends up happening there is some of it's sexism, I think, and then some of it is just where you get tracked or what you think you want to do. Women aren't, I think, still aren't encouraged enough from an early age to want to have the confidence to report on serious topics and to do the deep dives that it takes to report real news. So what ends up happening is a lot of women end up doing features or softer coverage. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, and some want to do it, but I think that it ends up being where they don't believe that they can. Then, the bottom line issue, just like in so many industries, is that men still run most of the newsrooms. White men still run most of the newsrooms, or men, and they're more African-American men, and they're not as many, for instance, as many women of any race running newsrooms. I mean, think real quick, how many newsrooms in the state of Mississippi that you know of any kind of newsroom, TV, radio, print, are actually run by a woman?
Well, I don't know.
You.
Right. This company, not
except
excluded.
For you.
Right. There just aren't that many, and there used to be more. When we first started, the Clarion Ledger was run by a woman editor who's now, I think, in Atlanta. There just aren't as many, and so it becomes this kind of, you know, we could get into these issues of women in authority anyway, and kind of some of the, the difficulties for women in management. That you even run into in media, and that, you know, I've dealt with a lot, you know, with people just not want, you know, people who will, it's fine if Todd tells them one thing, and if I tell them right. The very same thing, then I'm the witch, you know, and that kind of thing. So some of that comes into play. And then I think it's who gets promoted. You know, I went to Columbia Graduate School for Journalism, and there are plenty of women there. And so how does that translate into, you know, you have so many women in journalism schools, and then you get out into the real newsrooms, and And the people who are in the positions to really tell needed stories are often white men. And that accounts for a lot of the problems in the coverage.
Yeah, you brought up something that all of a sudden my mind jumped to, an Amazon special. I don't know if you saw it, Good Girls Revolt.
I love it, yeah.
And, oh, I just love that. Donna, did you or Kate see it?
I just finished watching it, so yeah.
Anne, did you get a chance to see it?
I did not. And this actually brings me to something that I was thinking about as Donna was speaking. I think not just in journalism, but in general, you see in graduate schools and in higher education, actually larger numbers of women in general, but in the professions, we still aren't seeing that. And as someone who's technically a millennial, right, I'm fairly young, I'm just starting to wrap my head around that gap. I think there was this great hope that in one generation or maybe two generations, we were going to wipe that out and achieve workplace equality. But what we're seeing in third wave feminism is a lot of discussion about there was the talk of the glass ceiling for a really long time, but we've seen a shift to the conversation about what they call the maternal wall. Mm-hmm. And so until we have equity in the domestic front, and until we get the opportunity for women to be able to, because for better or worse, we're the only ones who can literally physically carry and give birth to a child.
Yeah.
Until we reckon with that seriously, we're going to have women early in their careers taking a huge time out, which then takes the men who were in those same classes, they use that moment and they get ahead in those, whether it's 9 months, 2 years, even if there's no parental leave. I can tell you right now, I was as sick as anything when I was pregnant, and I had to pause pretty hard in my life and really stopped making such great strides in my career. Whereas my husband, who is wonderful and supportive, wasn't sick when I was pregnant.
Right.
And so he's able to blaze forward. And so we're seeing those dynamics at play. And then that only becomes increasing when our culture, you know, if our baby is sick, our culture, the daycare calls me. And that's just the way it works is we have all of these assumptions. And so right in that moment where families are starting to emerge, if that's something that women are choosing to do, that changes that dynamic immensely. Whereas in graduate school, we were all full-time graduate students, and that was everything. And so we were able to, and this right here is such a privileged conversation, right? We're all talking about graduate school and the assumption that that's where the difference is made. Well, I mean, how many people are privileged enough to get to even go to graduate school? And so if those conversations are amplified in my extremely privileged sphere, how much more so in spheres where there are even fewer safety nets and women are even held to higher standards in family situations than men? That's just got to be really
tough. It seems like we've been fighting this, you know, being challenged by this forever. Mm-hmm. And have we made any headway on it? It feels like all of a sudden you get ahead and then you take a deep breath and it feels like we've kind of been pushed a little bit backwards, and you know, we keep trying to move ahead with this. Kate, you're in the tech world.
Yeah.
So what do you experience there?
Well, the tech world has gotten a lot of press over the last few years, quite rightly, for being very white and very male. And it's very interesting having a front row seat to that conversation, because the conversations that all the companies are having is the right conversation, which is we need to expand the workforce, we need to be more diverse, we need to be more inclusive. But kind of like the maternity wall that you were talking about, there's a midpoint in careers where coming into the workforce, young women are coming in fairly large numbers. And I don't think it's all tied to the maternal wall, but there's a level at mid-management where women aren't promoted for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And you can get into the psychology of that. So that's an issue that tech companies are trying to address through a lot of training, especially the big buzzword right now is unconscious bias. So teaching people how they react to people in an unconscious way that can be for good or for ill. And then they're also looking at, honestly, at technology solutions. Like, can you use software to scan resumes and look at them in a more objective way, and using artificial intelligence and machine learning to help improve that?
Yeah, it's so going to be sad that it would take a robot to get around sexism.
I wonder who made the robots, if the robots are going to die.
It's like
they programmed
it.
So, and And so, and that, but to me, that's part of it is that hiring pipeline. Mm-hmm. And that's when I think about what Mississippi has to offer, particularly the tech culture, because that's what I swim around in. We have a very high population of African Americans. The tech companies are desperate for African Americans. I would love to see some organization, and I don't know who that is, you know, work with the School for Math and Science up in Columbus, the high school, work with Jackson mm-hmm. State, connect them with recruiters from the tech industry, because the more I travel, the longer I live in Mississippi and the more I travel outside of Mississippi, I'm always struck by how many white people there are in other places. and not just in, you know, Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's a strength of ours. Mm-hmm. And the only people I've heard talking about this kind of talk about, oh, well, we need to teach people to code so we can have coding centers here. I'm like, that's one step, but mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. like having a call center in Mississippi or a call center in India. You know, mm-hmm. they have coding centers in India now. Mm-hmm. And yes, we could have some here, and yes, it's a great source of employment. But I think there's a real value to diversity, and people from Mississippi have a really unique perspective. Mm-hmm. And it would be great if some of the global companies could start to tap into that.
Yeah, sure. And even when I was at Columbia, you know, yeah, it was graduate school, and it was Columbia student loans, but still, wasn't that privileged. But what was true is there was a remarkable amount of sexism even mm-hmm. there, mm-hmm. and you know, implicit racism, really, when it came down to it, mm-hmm. and apologize to my alma mater for saying that out loud, but, you know, it's me. But, like, let me tell a quick story. When I was applying to go to Columbia, we didn't have to do the test, that the graduate school test, we had to do things for Columbia. And so one of the things that we had to write something to make sense, and we had to take a current events exam, you know, and I think it was 30 questions that you just have to answer to show that you pay attention to the news. Fine. So the remarkable thing about that test is that only, if I recall correctly, and I believe I am, only one answer was a woman, like, of newsmakers.
Wow.
And it was for the last year. And then that one was Toni Morrison. And mm-hmm. so it kind of hit black and woman, you know, at the same time. And I was kind of aghast at this, right? And so when I got there and I was meeting with a professor who didn't end up being my advisor, but it was somebody who was giving me some advice when I first got there, I pointed this out to him. You know, it's like, there was only one woman newsmaker on there. And he said, well, that's because women didn't make much news last year. And I just, like, wanted to slam my head on the desk. Because for me, there's no better example of, like, mm-hmm. This implicit bias than someone saying that and using that circular logic. I mean, that's just absurd. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so I saw a lot of that there. And then you get in, like, within journalism, and I know it's true in other industries too, but you get into this problem of people wanting to hire people like them all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for a while, I was the diversity chair for the Association of Alternative News Media, which are like papers like ours around the country. And I'm talking about in cities like Memphis and Atlanta, Dallas, Chicago, you know, cities that are pretty diverse. And, you know, our board and their board, which I'm no longer on because I finally resigned, was all white, and it's still all white. Uh-huh. And at the time that I was on the board, bless their hearts, it was like all of these, there were women on there, probably about a third. But the women, if you spoke up about something and started talking, they'd shut you down. It was just, and these are progressive newspapers from around the country. This is just true. Mm-hmm. One of the men on the board was trying to get one of the publishers, who's a female friend of mine, a woman friend of mine, who happens to be a lesbian, to go watch porn with him in his hotel room. I mean, this just happened.
Right.
And everybody was so delighted by this guy. They thought he was great. He'd been there a long time. And I'm looking at him like a dirty old man. I'm like, mm-hmm. why is this happening? And so, you know, it was just beating my head against the wall And we were really working on ethnic diversity, you know, but these other things, and then the women who are on the board, prominent editors and publishers of big papers, have been around a lot longer than mine had, would tell me at the bar later, we'll talk about this, because I would speak up and talk about things, even though they would shut me down. And so it was just this, and so I've seen that so much out there, and it is astonishingly implicit. And when I say that, it's like, yeah, it's implicit bias, but how the heck can you not actually see that bias in yourself? Yeah.
Well, you raise a really interesting... I've had this phenomenon happen to me countless times as well as a sort of extreme extrovert person who's literally paid to have my voice heard, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a musician and a vocalist and a cantor. I just don't have a lot of filters, and I don't... Who knows where it came from? If it's from me being raised in the middle of nowhere, rural Midwest, where I didn't have a lot of censors, I don't know. But I've never really felt pulled back from speaking up. And I always thought that was sort of the way people were, and I couldn't figure out why women weren't doing that. But it is really fascinating how I think that the risk is really high. Some women have experienced that the risk of truth-telling is really, really high. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are I wish I could say it was that I'm willing to do it anyway and I'm brave. That's not it at all. I wish I would stop doing it. It just comes out of my mouth. But it's one of those things where we really need to be able to insert our voices into these conversations. And for me, the metaphor is pretty literal, right? Is, for example, as a musician who often works in religious settings, if you look at just a hymnal, hymnals, the songs in them are written largely by white men for white men. And what that means, not only is God called Father, 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 Father throughout, which is one metaphor for God, but a limited one, the actual key that the songs are written in are better suited to male voices.
Wow.
So women are literally being silenced by the hymns that we sing because they're too high for our voices.
Wow.
Because if we sing what's on the page, just an octave up, unless we're professionally trained, that's not a comfortable space for us to sing in, because women and men's voices aren't actually an octave separate. They're a few notes separate in sort of, you know, on a spectrum, of course, but it's we're literally being intentionally silenced. Maybe not intentionally, but actually silenced.
Well, one wonders if it how
right.
intentional
and how, and
it
why,
might
because,
be.
You know, these were originally written for men in boys choirs, and obviously in religious traditions there have been written out religious laws that say women are not to speak in church and women are not to do X, Y, and Z, and that manifests itself. And unless we speak up and we change these things, those of us who can't help ourselves but speak up, that's not going to change, right? And so as someone who plans these services for big cathedrals and big conferences, and we now have the technology, I look at what's in the hymnal and I change the key it's in. I put it in my computer and I print it in the bulletin, because why would we sing a high E when that's not pleasant for anyone to hear or have to do? So yeah, we have to use the skills that we have to make it possible for these other voices to be heard.
All right, speaking of voices being heard, we're going to take a short break and we're going to be right back. As I mentioned in the intro, Anne is a musician. She's part of a group called Theodicy Jazz Collective. Let's listen to a sample of one of the songs from their album. We've been listening to Wade Through the Water performed by the Odyssey Jazz Collective from their album Vespers. For more information or to purchase the album, go to theodysseyjazz.com. TheOdysseyJazz.com. Okay, we're back. Let's take this. Keep going. Go ahead.
You know, over the break we were talking about what you had said about hymns and hymnals and how they're not, you know, designed for women.
Yeah, not just the lyrics, but the actual physical music. Yeah,
and that just never would have occurred to me. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe it, sadly.
I believe it. Mm-hmm. Having listened to people sing in church, I believe it.
Yeah. And by the way, I want you to write a column for me about that, because that would be amazing.
I would love to. You know, I would love to. Speaking of voices, I'm such an extrovert that I'm much better at the interaction, and you have to sit me down and make me write. So that'd be great. You know this.
I know. She was in my writing class. But, well, you know, we're talking about columns, and you know, as we were sitting here talking, you know, I get obsessed with things like noticing in the media what they're doing on all sorts of diversity. And if y'all don't mind me talking a little bit about the Clarion Ledger, the newspaper downstairs over there, but
only if you bring in Jackson Free Press.
Yes. No, but no, I mean, it's a negative though, because you know, when we first came back to Mississippi and then started Jackson Free Press, which is 15 years ago now. But, you know, the Ledger daily newspaper here, it had a female editor. Gannett, their parent companies was really into diversity and talking about it all the time. And they had a black editor later. And but now what's funny is that it's, you know, now it's male, it's white male run again. But the thing that gets me is their columns in their Sunday edition. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you look in the perspective section, I believe they call it, the opinion section, it's multi-pages, and I count them every week, and what the, because I noticed how bad it was. Mm-hmm. I didn't just go to count them, I was like, white man, white man, white man, black man, black man, white man, white man, white man, oh, there's Ann Coulter, you know, and it's, but here's the thing, it's astonishing to me how that goes out the door in 2017. This is my point.
In Jackson, Mississippi.
How do you, I mean, like 10 columns, maybe one is a woman, right? If it's two in a week, it's astonishing. Mm-hmm. It's just like, whoa, you know? Mm-hmm. And so my point is, and this is the way it was when I was the, you know, on the board of this this media organization. How do you not notice these things? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where the implicit part comes from. Mm-hmm. But if you're talking, mm-hmm. but it actually happens in rooms where people talk about diversity.
Yes.
Like you're talking about in the tech world.
Oh, yeah.
They talk about diversity of all sorts, and then they do nothing about it, and their products go out looking that way. And mm-hmm. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. Like in this case, if you don't have women writing serious columns, I mean, this is an obvious statement I'm about to make, about politics and social mm-hmm. issues and economics and other things, then our young women aren't seeing women having those opinions. Mm-hmm. So when we go back to the beginning of this conversation about why women particularly aren't in the more serious parts of journalism, mm-hmm. well, there's one reason.
Sure.
It doesn't look like it's open to them.
And not only that, but in this era that we've entered into recently, we're very clear on how much media shapes policy. So mm-hmm. not only is women not writing, not having their voices heard is so significant, but also the things that are more significantly impacting women, mm-hmm. such as, again, I have a small child, so I go back to this, but this parental leave thing, right? Mm-hmm. I should be able to have maternity leave, but also my husband should have paternity leave, mm-hmm. so that he also has the opportunity to bond with our child, to prioritize the domestic sphere, and gives me the chance to, you know, to be on par with him professionally. Not that we both have to take it, not that everyone has mm-hmm. to, one person might prefer the domestic sphere more than the other, but the option needs to be there.
I want you to keep talking about that, and I'm going to step on you for just a moment, because when you brought that up, mm-hmm. I didn't realize this until very recently, that the United States is one of two mm-hmm. developed countries mm-hmm. that it is not mandated or required mm-hmm. by law for women to be allowed maternity leave.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so for someone in my career, that's a bummer, right? It's hard. We make ends meet. We figure it out as someone who works in a fairly flexible world. But I think about some of my friends here in Jackson who dad isn't in the picture. and isn't paying any money, isn't, and oftentimes is incarcerated, right? Not saying that all men are incarcerated and women aren't, but I'm not trying to make stereotypes there. But in situations where the biological father isn't paying anything for multiple reasons, the woman not only doesn't get leave, but might lose their job, is the sole supporter of the family, and is likely not making a whole lot, because how can you re-enter the workforce when you've been completely fixated on keeping this teeny tiny person alive? Mm-hmm. It's the inequity for my situation is frustrating. The inequity for the situations of so many other people in our community is absolutely devastating.
Kate?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, you raised two, I want you to keep that going, but you raised two girls. I watched you raise those girls. And you raised them here in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you say a little bit about that? It's pretty impressive, I have to admit.
Well, part of, I think, why my girls are super awesome and impressive.
And they are.
is because I worked, and because I married a man who was smart enough to appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And he, when our kids were born, you know, I took four months, I think, of maternity leave mm-hmm. with each one. Mm-hmm. And then he took a month off when I went back to work. And I will, my oldest child is 20 years old. She's about to be 21.
Mm. God, unbelievable.
So, but I still remember to this day, the first day I went back to work, and he was at home, and I was leaving the house, and he's standing there in his pajamas and bathrobe with this little bundle in his arms. And he said, "What do I do?" And I said, "Keep her alive." And I walked out the door. And sure enough, I got home, you know, eight or nine hours later. And he, I don't think, ever showered that day, but she was still alive. But he had so much more confidence in his ability to take care of his child.
Yeah.
And you can't, that's the thing that kind of breaks my heart about a lot of the men that I see, particularly in economies like Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're in a stable relationship where they're the primary breadwinner and the mom stays at home, that many of them miss out on taking care of their kids
Absolutely.
In a really fundamental way. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's just sad across the board. It's sad for the kids, it's sad for the marriage, and I think it's sad for the dads.
So I
hear what you're saying too about, you know, I'm coming definitely from a point of privilege that we both were employed full time. But I think part of that maternal wall that you were talking about earlier, there's a tendency, and I don't have research to back this up. Sheryl Sandberg talks about it in Lean In, mm-hmm. about don't quit before you quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, a lot of times you see this, and actually I went through it in my 20s, which is, you kind of know at some point you'll get married and have kids. Yeah. So as you're choosing your path in your career, you maybe take the easier path because you think, well, how will I be able to handle kids if I do this bigger job?
Mm-hmm.
And the point in that book, which, you know, it works for some people, is take the bigger job because you don't know what's going to happen. You may not have kids, or even if you do have kids, having a big job is something that will inspire you and make you want to come back to work. Mm-hmm. And that's really key as well, because working and raising kids is hard. And Sheryl Sandberg rightly got a lot of flack for being the most overprivileged white woman in the world. But if you... You know, she still struggled with it, with a very supportive husband, lots of money, nannies, you know, personal trainers out the wazoo. So, yes, it's really hard. So it's important to have work that's meaningful, that gives you the inspiration to do both, to work and raise kids.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back. If you have followed Faith and Reason for the past 20 years, you know Sister Joan Chittister. If you don't know Sister Joan Chittister, look her up. Let's listen to a portion of a lecture, American Women and Women of the World, that Joan presented in Houston, Texas in 2013.
It's a tragedy to doom an entire class of people to lives of diminished expectations, but it's immoral to condemn them to lives of unfinished possibilities. And yet for generations, someone somewhere has decided that women need less, that women deserve less, and that women are worth less than the rest of the human race. And as a result of that kind of thinking, women are 2/3 of the illiterate of the world, as we sit here this morning. Women are 2/3 of the starving of the world, because husbands and children eat first, and women eat what's left over. And women are 2/3 of the poorest of the poor everywhere. That cannot be an accident. That's a policy. Somebody somewhere decided that's all a woman needed, that's all a woman's worth. And that must be changed by those of us of the other 1/3. Don't tell me that you and your churches care for the poor, but then can absolutely, positively do nothing, nothing whatsoever for women as women.
Again, that was Sister Joan Chittister speaking from her lecture, American Women and Women of the World, now available streaming on Amazon. All right, we're back. I want to touch on this real quick, and then Donna, I don't want to lose the idea of us going back and revisiting this 1969 true story event. For Easter, I just bought my two granddaughters a book for their Easter baskets. They're 9 and 11, almost. It's called Nighttime Stories for Rebel Girls. Okay, here's my point. I mean, not only do I want them to read these stories and to have a different perspective about how they can approach their life, their careers, but the title itself kind of brings me into a little uncomfortable place. Mm-hmm. I raise the question, why is it called Rebel Girls? So why do we have to rebel just to be equal? Mm-hmm. It just seems to be... it's old.
This suggestion that in order for girls to be active agents in society, it's intuitively rebellious, it's intrinsically rebellious, is such a troubling notion. Yes. And I was mentioning a little while ago, I'm raising a little boy, right? A little white boy who is basically the epitome of privilege. He has two parents who met as graduate students at Yale. He has got every safety net that the world could possibly afford a person. The questions of what's wrong with our society, it shouldn't all be on people who are raising girls, because I'm raising a little white boy who, with so much privilege, if he's not able to be self-aware, he could be a monster. He could be a dangerous agent in society, and it is not just on these little girls to edge their way into his games, but for him to understand that they are key players as much as he is. All human beings are. And so I don't know what that looks like right now, but I really want to reclaim that narrative that raising boys, we need to be, you know, he has had a feminist onesie that he wore when he was a few weeks old. And we play a little game with his stuffed animals where before they get in bed with him at night, they have to ask, William, can I come in your bed? Because you always ask before you get in someone's bed. And that is really important, raising a boy, that he knows that.
So what are you putting in his little Easter basket?
Right? Exactly. Probably sidewalk chalk, because it's basically the only thing keeping me sane.
Oh, yeah. Sidewalk chalk is terrific. Okay, Donna, let's go back to this 1969 episode of Good Girls Rebel.
Well, I think it ties to what Revolt. You're saying in my head. It's like, because, you know, one of the things I write about a lot is, and my partner Todd writes about this as well, because we're in agreement on this, but it's seeing these double standards, and even with rape and with domestic abuse and these kinds of issues, so often things are put on the girl, you know, premarital sex, teenage, you know, all of these things. Single mothers. How often do we hear about single fathers? Yeah. You know, and how many single fathers are there out there running around?
Right.
And so, it's things that we need to be talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's in opinion pieces or conversations, that women would talk about more if they had those spaces to express themselves, or they could talk about, or men talk about them.
Right.
Like, you know, I say to Todd, when he wants to write one of those columns, I'm thrilled about that because it's coming from him and not me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of tie that back to that TV series, Good Girls Revolt. I didn't really know what we were getting into when I watched it, and it was, you know, it's about journalism and about all these young women who really wanted to write, but they were the researchers or whatever they
researchers, right.
Basically secretaries, essentially,
right.
For all these young men who were doing the great journalism in the 60s. And I watch that, and I just think about this. It's like they didn't have those voices at all. They were trying to fight for them. And then the way they were treated in the workplace, mm-hmm. you know, how disrespectfully but they were treated. But what that ties to me for in kind of current day experiences is that young women, even I did this. I was a feminist in high school and then really loud about it and in college. And then I got out and then I kind of bought into this idea that sexism was behind us. I'm young, mm-hmm. I'm doing all these other things, not having to worry about it. It wasn't really until I got into a position of authority and of having a loud voice in the community on issues that matter that I really felt sexism hit me mm-hmm. straight in the face again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really thought I was kind of past it, and women get trained a little bit not to talk about being a feminist or being mm-hmm. about sexism because then you're angry mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, all these other things. And so it's easier sometimes not to do it. I was a feminist, I just didn't talk about it a lot. And then all these things started happening, and I think it ties back into the issue with our industries, because even in this job in the last 10 years, the stories I could tell you about mm-hmm. Men who worked for me, and some women, because the studies show that it's men and women can
absolutely.
Do it, who were so remarkably disrespectful, just in the sense of just over basic, mm-hmm. you know, interactions between a manager and an employee. Just great. Like, I had somebody sit in front of me at one point. It was a serious conversation and about something he had not done that he needs to do in serious journalism, you know, contact people that were criticizing and all that. And he's like, I've been doing this for 25 years or whatever he said. I could not possibly have this conversation with him. So I tell these stories to say that it is, for me, it's like this new realization. So when I watch Good Girls Revolt, I look at it and say, some of that's flipped. It's like, so women get into a position of authority. Y'all, I cannot tell you how many times in the last 3 to 4 years that I have had to have Todd come in the room as I'm having to talk to a male employee. Now, that's not true for anybody who's there any longer, but because they were so incredibly disrespectful, and Todd will call it sexism before I will, because he just sees how it changes when he's there. And so these are things that I think that women, young women, like even in my own office, which is majority women, and all our managers other than Todd's female, but I think they see this happening to women. Mm-hmm. And with some of them, I think it makes them hesitant to go into management roles because it's you get it from all sides.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's for me working in the religious sphere, it plays into my reluctance to get ordained. I mean, I don't even want to have those conversations. I don't even want to have to do that. Mm-hmm. And I have a multitude of reasons not to get ordained at this point, but that was a piece of it very early on. And you know, that double standard plays out on the other side of the coin as well. I have a friend from my hometown in rural Nebraska, and he is a stay-at-home dad, and he's always posting all of these amazing pictures of his adorable children on Facebook, and it's great photography. And constantly my progressive friends, especially, are saying, oh, you're so amazing for being a stay-at-home dad. Like, you are the beacon of hope. And then women that we grew up with will post similar cute pictures of their kids on Instagram, and another picture of a baby that I have to look at, right? So these men get to be heralded for doing this thing that so many women want to do. And if they do it, then they are considered less than. And this is what you're talking about, that sort of imbibing that sexism, that internalized misogyny, that we as women do this, right? I look at him and I say, what an amazing guy to be a stay-at-home dad. But if I would make that choice myself to be a stay-at-home mom, I would feel like a sellout.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all this talk of youngsters. Now, one of the things that I think is important about women having voices, and actually everybody having a voice, is I work in technology, and if you haven't noticed, the pace of technological change is getting faster and faster with each passing month. And what's starting to happen is there is so much cheap, usable technology that it's impacting how we do business, how we do our lives. I mean, think about, you know, 10 years ago when you didn't have an iPhone. And what technology companies are really hitting is that we need a diverse and we need a young workforce. And that, I think, in our industry, is going to be where the rubber meets the road, is what companies survive over the next 10 and 15 years are the ones that can actually make the change away from being the brotastic culture filled with the programmers or whatever in that article, and really make that change. And that's where I'm personally kind of hopeful that there is, you know, and studies have shown that there is real positive business impact when you have women running the company, when you have women on the board, when you have women as senior managers. And that's not just women, that's diversity of age, of ability, of race, of ethnicity, of religion, economics, all of it. I listened to our CEO talk, and he talks very explicitly about creating a safe and welcoming environment for anybody who wants to work at SAP who's qualified. And that, I think, is really important, and it gives me a lot of hope, especially the way things are going now, that I do think that this generation that's coming along that is that's grown up so much on social media, and people complain about that, but I think it's fantastic because they're exposed to so many ideas and so many people and so many cultures that diversity comes naturally to them in a lot of different ways. And if we can nurture that, then companies will start to realize that they need that on a fundamental level. I mean, you know that in journalism, that's why you guys are successful, because you've actively cultivated a diverse community within Jackson.
Yeah. And I think one of the things you said there that stuck out at me almost like as a red flag word is this idea of qualified, because I think, I know how you meant it, and you meant it in the right way. But one of the things that we learned, it was an excuse for the AEN board when I was there to say, well, I can't find anybody who's qualified. And so people make qualified too often mean like them.
Yeah, right.
And so we have to really watch out for that. And then the other thing we have to do is to get pipelines going. It's really important. Like, we're sitting here at the Youth Media Project doing this. And, you know, a big point of the Youth Media Project is to tell these stories allow diverse young people to tell their own stories, to tell each other's stories, to tell the community stories, looking for solutions and all that, to get out to a larger audience. But also, we treat it as a startup mentality here. You know, they do SWOT analyses of their own projects. They learn these kind of professional and soft skills. They learn that, you know, the young men in the room aren't the only voices in the room. You know, we try to teach respect issues, all of these kinds of things, because we will continue hearing as we go forward that there aren't enough women, there aren't enough people of color, you know, fill in the blanks, qualified to work in tech, in media, in, you know, academia, whatever, probably not as much in academia, but it happens. If we don't do something about it, and that's kind of my point. It's like we have to take it on. So our kids here start as young as 14, and they're learning those skills. And a big part of that is so that we really can go out there and diversify these these industries and push back on these kind of these negative narratives.
Kate, you mentioned the article, so I just want to clarify that. It's the front, front cover of The Atlantic for this month, which is, of course, Women's History Month. And its title is "Why is Silicon Valley So Awful to Women?" It's a terrific article, and what you just mentioned about the youth media group, they mention a project called Project Inclusion. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they've put a lot of energy and effort into trying to address these very mm-hmm. issues. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to drop that in. And you were getting ready to say something.
Yeah, well, to sort of bring it full circle in this sort of faith and reason context that we're talking about is, it's really, both of you, what you're saying, the importance of the tech world and the importance of media to broaden the voices that they include because they want to remain relevant, right? It's not just that we need to bring in diversity because for diversity's
nice.
Sake,
yeah.
As your readership, as your the people who are buying whatever technology you're creating, they aren't all white people, right? The mm-hmm. the populace is not a bunch of white people. It's not a bunch of men. It's not, this diversity matters because as people
they're
move
not
in
even
the world,
all Christian.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you know. Precisely. So that's what it brings me to a conversation that I have over and over again, and why I have never worked at a church for more than 2 years at a time. but I'm constantly wanting to expand the notion of tradition. What are the traditions here? Why are they traditions here? And how can we expand them to be relevant and relatable for people who maybe didn't grow up in this pew singing this song this mm-hmm. way? And I always get pushback, and I don't like to use the word always unless I mean it, but I always get pushback saying, well, if we use a different metaphor for God than Father, people will leave. Or if we change this little word in the confession, it will upset the people who grew up here and they will leave. And there is this fixation in the churches I've been in, but I'm guessing in a lot of religious contexts, this fear of the people who are already there leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that is so funny because that just strikes me that that was something Jesus didn't really worry about. He wasn't really concerned with offending people,
mm-hmm.
but was deeply concerned about not the people who were there who might leave, but the people who weren't there and why
right.
not. Mm. So my question isn't if we yeah. don't, if we change this word, who will leave? My question is, if we don't update this model, if we don't alter this word, if we don't, who's not coming?
That's
who's
right.
not welcome
who's
here?
Not there?
We sit here at the first part of the service and we say, we are radically welcoming, all are welcome here. And then we use the same metaphors created by the same people in the same power structures. Mm-hmm. And unless we take seriously the fact that these people who aren't here are equally people to the people who are already in the inside, none of us have any hope of our industries moving forward.
Well, when we first started the Jackson Free Press, we were talking at the time, we were talking to this, kind of progressive white businessman in town, somebody had sent us to, who had put some money into another little newspaper that wasn't doing very well. And essentially the idea is that we might be able to merge with them. So we had a proposal for him and the whole thing. But a big part of our proposal was that this is going to be a diverse newspaper. It's going to be diverse in content, diverse in readership. We're going to distribute all over Jackson, in every zip code, la, 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 la. And he sat there and said to me, that sounds like a great idea, but I do not believe it can ever happen. Mm-hmm. That people throughout the city of Jackson will read a real newspaper that is real on these kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. And didn't believe us, and later on ended up giving us that newspaper's boxes after they went out of business. I mean, it was that kind of, and I don't even mean that as a judgment of him. I'm saying that to me illustrated this idea that you have to stay in mm-hmm. these little mm-hmm. pockets. I've had other newspaper publishers tell me the same thing. Well, we don't really, one of the reasons we don't cover more things in more parts of the city is because we're afraid we're going to lose readership in the white parts of the city. I mean, they'll literally admit that sometimes mm-hmm. when they're being honest about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's that, I agree with you, it's that mm-hmm. holding on to this small thing, mm-hmm. which is very short-sighted,
mm-hmm.
business-wise.
Right.
Yeah, as much as anything else.
Right.
I mean, morality is just,
well,
it's
and that's,
just, bacon.
That's exactly it. Is business-wise, it's a bad model, numbers-wise. Mm-hmm. But in the church, it's so egregious because if pressed, right, they'll say, well, the people who might feel welcome here if we change this don't have as deep of pockets as the people who will leave.
Yep. Yep.
And in
everything.
The business, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if you're proclaiming the gospel, blessed are the poor, that is unacceptable.
Right. It's unacceptable in media, too.
Yeah.
And it's part of the reason they're failing. I just want to say that.
Well,
a lot of media is failing is because they did mm-hmm. not, they have not figured out how to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
And so their products are suffering as a result.
Yep.
You know, I don't think people are given an opportunity to even consider whether you're Jewish or Muslim mm-hmm. or Christian, mm-hmm. whatever tradition, or even a nun, N-O-N-E, right. that they do not have to use masculine language.
Right.
They don't even realize how easy it is. Instead of saying father or mm-hmm. he or him, mm-hmm. you just use the word God.
Yeah. Right. You don't have to come up with something weird.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have to be shod or
I thought it was awesome. I'm going to start using it.
Please do. You can have
writing it into my notated hymns.
But right. It's like just don't do it. It's just like
just
when I make everybody
language,
change the passive voice so their writing's better.
Yes.
Just flip it.
Yeah.
Just do something
it.
Different.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
Or just run a few more women columnists mm-hmm. on the weekends.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, come find some of mine and get, you know, whatever. I mean, it's the most absurd
right.
thing.
Right.
And that's where I get my hope. You know, I have to pull my hope back up because it's mm-hmm. like if you can't even see the problem. That what you're telegraphing in that,
mm-hmm.
That's a problem. You know, that's
yeah,
the
that's
real problem,
the problem
is that you
yeah.
can't see it. Like
right.
that guy at Columbia.
Yeah,
it's like you've got to recognize that this
well,
is a problem.
And that's what I loved about watching Good Girls Revolt mm-hmm. on Amazon Prime, and also Hidden Figures
mm-hmm.
was just having that visual,
mm-hmm.
And because. You know that it happens, and you know as a woman, certain things happen to you during your career, and so you have a sense. But seeing it on the screen, in living color, is just astonishing. And yeah, I don't want to squash the hope, but it is striking to me that both Hidden Figures and Good Girls Revolt.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of came with it away from both of them, going, "Wow, those were amazing, amazing actresses, great storyline, well done." Good Lord, so little has changed.
Yeah.
And by the way, Good Girls Revolt was not renewed for season two by Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And recently read, actually, Jennifer, who works with us, pointed out to me that in reviewing why it wasn't renewed by Amazon, it was an all-male panel, all-male committee.
In
that
no
refused.
You just can't make it up.
Yeah.
You can't.
You
know?
Yeah.
Because you know,
they watched that last scene where they're trying to figure out the cover of the magazine.
Well,
I think
in the very last episode. You know, there were moments I cried during that show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because it hurt so much mm-hmm. as a journalist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I cried all through that and all through Hidden Figures. Just, oh,
I mean, I think that name, right, Hidden Figures, is really mm-hmm. telling that there's so much that women have done, even throughout history, before women could document the work that they were doing while men were, you know, going out and to the agora and living the public life, the work that women have done in hidden spaces for so long. And I think that brings us to why we can't let ourselves be silenced, we can't let ourselves be hidden anymore, and why, much as I would like to sometimes, I just won't shut up.
You know, the one thing that I think a lot about these days is the need to speak up on behalf of other women.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to a point, I like to call myself Teflon now, and for the most part, that's true. You know, I've had every part of my body challenged and all sorts of horrible things because I'm willing to speak out. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think we have to challenge. Mm-hmm. And even at the risk of somebody saying, oh, you're angry or whatever, the truth is I'm not angry. You know, not really. I mean, on some level, maybe, but I'm angry that this keeps continuing.
Mm-hmm.
You're not hurting my feelings because I can see that you're being a problem, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that. But if I don't speak out and call out, especially among these progressive men who think they've got it all figured out, then you're going to continue doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my thing, is that this is going to be the barrier to entry to other young women who see how you talk to me. And that I don't challenge you back.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so I've kind of moved into this space now, you know, after you turn 50, you just don't really care about what anybody thinks, you know.
That's
but
right.
It's like I've moved into that space where it's like, I'm just going to challenge you. You know, I'm going to try to do it in a relatively respectful, loving way, depending on what it is you're saying to me. But
mm-hmm.
but it's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I want other young women and other marginalized people as well to see that. It's like, I'm going to speak up. When I see it, I'm going to speak up.
You really don't have a choice. The way the world is moving forward, sometime in the next 10, 20 years, you're going to need all kinds of different perspectives in your business, in your church, mm-hmm. in your paper, to help us solve the problems that are headed our way, that are already here. And so think about that, and think about not just about yourself, but as Donna was talking about, you know, let's nurture the pipeline, because the kids are coming along. They're going to be the ones inheriting what we've left for them. So let's do what Donna says. Let's pave the way. Let's speak up where people are doing stupid things and the wrong things, and help the next generation come along, find their voice, because they're the ones that are going to solve all the problems ahead of us when we're coasting into doddering old age.
And I'd say my final thoughts are really similar. Actually, the sign I carry, Donna, what you just said about raising your voice up to speak on behalf of others, the sign I carried at the Women's March in D.C. was a Malala Yousafzai quote, and it was, "I raise up my voice not so that I can shout, but so that those without a voice can be heard." Mm-hmm. And that, the way that we say that in sort of theological conversation is often, how do we use our privilege toward justice? Mm-hmm. I'm incredibly privileged to be given broad audiences, and literally often I'm the only one in the room holding a microphone. And that is an incredible vocal privilege that I have. And so I have to use that voice toward justice. I can't deny my privilege. I have to confess it and use it toward that justice. Mm-hmm. And so I often say that a lot of the ideas I have rub people the wrong way and can really chafe against some modern sensibilities, often especially of those of some men in power. Not all men in power, but some. But what I found is that when I say something, I might get resistance. When I sing it, people listen. Hmm. And that's why I will continue to do it through music and art.
That wraps up this episode of Faith and Reason 360. Thanks for joining us. Please follow us on social media. Next month, Ann Phelps will join us again with special guest John Dominic Crossan discussing the resurrection.